Most of us have had painful experiences with classmates or coworkers or teammates. And most of us have faced bosses or coworkers or teammates who wanted us to fail or to get fired. But probably none of us has faced anything close to that which was faced by Jackie Robinson. Now, just in case you're not a baseball fan, let me tell you a little bit about Robinson, starting with his number, 42. One of the greatest honors that a baseball team can convey upon a retired player is to retire that player's number, which means that no one on that team will ever wear that number again. So if you go to the Metrodome, you will see the numbers that have been retired from the Minnesota Twins. And they include Harmon Killebrew, whose number is, I'll find out who's into baseball and who is not. How about Tony Oliva? 6. Apparently it's everybody concentrated in this one section. How about Rod Carew? 29, right. Okay, how about Kent Terbeck? 14. How about, I wish I could say this like the announcer, but Kirby Puckett. You laughed, I didn't hear the number. 34. But if you go to the Twins website, the first number that's listed is 42. Jackie Robinson, who never played for the Twins and never played against the Twins. But Jackie Robinson's number has been retired from all of Major League Baseball. So no one on any team wears the number 42. Robinson is the only one. Jackie Robinson was first recruited to join the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947. He was then, and continued to be for a while, the only African-American player in the American major leagues. As a result, fans often insulted him. They shouted racial slurs. There were whole teams that threatened to strike rather than play the Brooklyn Dodgers simply because they had a black player on the team. There were players on opposing teams that would slide into second base at Robinson with their spikes up, hoping to injure him, one time cutting a 7-inch gash into his leg. When the Dodgers general manager, then Branch Rickey, hired Robinson, he warned him about what to expect. He said it could be like this. He said that others would hate him and mistreat him and shout the racial slurs, and he asked that Jackie Robinson not fight back. Robinson at first said, well, what do you mean? You don't want me to stand up for yourself? And Branch Rickey said, I want a baseball player with guts enough not to fight back. You've got to do the job with base hits, stolen bases, and fielding ground balls, Jackie. Nothing else. Branch Rickey predicted that there would be players that would actually come up to him and make a fist and haul off and slug him in his right cheek. And Branch Rickey said, well, what are you going to do when that happens? And Jackie Robinson said, I have a left cheek, following the words of Jesus about turning the other cheek. In the Bible story of David, it wasn't his teammates who were out to get him. It was his boss. And his boss's name was Saul. David did everything pretty much right, did a really good job, and his boss hated him anyway. It is a story of rising jealousy, and it begins with the relationship between David, a young man in his teens or perhaps his early 20s, and a friendship that he had with Prince Jonathan, the crown prince of Israel. They were the best of friends. In 1 Samuel 18, after David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return to his father's house. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe that he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. God intended to replace Saul as the king of Israel, although it wasn't announced. The prophet Samuel had gone to Bethlehem and anointed David to become the successor king, but I'm not even sure that David understood why he was being anointed, other than that God had something special in the future for him. But it seems almost as if Jonathan had a premonition, anticipated what was going to come. They were such good friends. David was so godly, so good, so winsome, that Jonathan loved him more than if he were a brother. And anticipating that perhaps he would not ascend to the throne, but that David would instead, in an amazing act of humility and friendship, he took off his royal robe and he gave it to David, along with the other insignia of the monarchy. It said a lot about Jonathan. I think you could say it may compare to a family-owned business today that is large and lucrative and successful. And there is a son of the president and the CEO who will inherit the company and will inherit the presidency of that company. But there's an outsider, a rising employee, a young man who is very good. And the son's successor decides to give the corner office to his best friend, who is not a member of the family. That's what Jonathan was doing. He really loved David. But what did that say to his father? What did King Saul think of all this? What did he give as his own analysis of this astonishing friendship between these two 20-somethings? Did he resent that they had a greater loyalty to each other than they had to him as their king? And then to this rising tide of jealousy, add these repeated good performance reviews that David got, A++ every time. Whatever Saul sent him to do, David did it so successfully that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. This pleased all the people and Saul's officers as well. David did everything well, every assignment he finished. He was promoted through the ranks of the army ahead of other officers who were older and had greater tenure. But even they celebrated it. Even they thought that was a wonderful thing. And Saul must have wondered if they were more loyal to him than they were to the king. And then there was a pop song that some anonymous author wrote, and it swept through the nation until people were singing it in the streets. When the men were returning home after David had killed the Philistine, the women came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul with singing and dancing, with joyful songs and with tambourines and lutes. As they danced, they sang, "Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands." Music and lyrics can sometimes capture the heart of a nation, a people, in a way that laws and speeches don't. And this was a song of happiness. It was a joy of celebration, a song of celebration and joy. It was patriotic because the nation of Israel had been subjugated to the Philistines and other neighbor enemies for years and years. And now, at last, unexpectedly, they were winning battles. And the people were thrilled. They were excited. They were grateful that Saul was their king and their leader, and they celebrated him with the song, and David with the song as well. But it was poetry. It wasn't literal. Actually, the translation from the Hebrew words into English, it's not an exact number, 10,000. It just means a big number. It wasn't a put-down of Saul in any way. It was just excitement and celebration and a compliment. But Saul couldn't get the song out of his head. He thought about it when he went to bed at night and when he woke up in the morning. Saul was very angry. This refrain galled him. "They have credited David with tens of thousands," he thought, "but me with only thousands. What more can he get but the kingdom?" And from that time on, Saul kept a jealous eye on David. Perhaps it was the combination of things. The friendship between his son Jonathan and David, the officers who celebrated his promotion, David's constant successes, this song that was sung everywhere that Saul went. And it all came together and his heart turned against David. And he became resentful and envious and jealous. And jealousy can destroy a person. There was a strange burst of crazy jealousy at the Teddy Bear Museum in Western England in 2006. It seems that Greg West, the night watchman, had a dog that was a Doberman, and together they would protect the Teddy Bear Museum. But on one awful day in 2006, the Doberman got kind of crazy and attacked 100 of the teddy bears, ripping them apart. And especially the Doberman attacked Mabel. Now, if you're not a teddy bear expert, you might not realize that Mabel was Elvis Presley's teddy bear. And a rich aristocrat in England had bought Mabel for $75,000 and lent the teddy bear to the Teddy Bear Museum. So the police investigation included an interview of Greg West, in which he finally admitted that that day he had pet Mabel and said nice things to her. And the Doberman was in rage with jealousy and ripped Mabel apart. And the rest is just teddy bear history. Now, you know, it's kind of funny when it's a Doberman and a teddy bear, but it's not so funny when it's us. So what is it that triggers your jealousy? A relationship between a couple of people that excludes you. Somebody else getting promoted. Somebody else getting the attention that you think you deserve. Somebody else doing a really good job. Someone else getting the credit. Someone else who is powerful or is on the team or has a friendship that you wish you could have. Jealousy is a powerful drug that can trigger really bad behavior. And Saul had a long list of responses that was bad behavior. It started with impulsive violence. The next day, an evil spirit from God came forcefully upon Saul. He was prophesying in his house while David was playing the harp, as he usually did. Saul had a spear in his hand, and he hurled it, saying to himself, "I'll pin David to the wall." But David eluded him twice. So Saul was melting down. His sin had led to jealousy, and his jealousy had its consequences in that God sent or allowed to come to him a mood that was a negative mood that Saul allowed to take over his entire thinking. So he became erratic and unstable and unpredictable. One minute he's connected to God, he's prophesying. The next minute he's grabbing a spear and throwing it at a harpist in the middle of a private recital. I'll just tell you, it's always a bad sign at work when your boss throws a spear at you. But it's also a bad sign when your boss sort of seesaws back and forth between rationality and rage. And that was the bad behavior of King Saul. He began to set up David to lose. Saul was afraid of David because the Lord was with David but had left Saul. So he sent David away from him and gave him command over 1,000 men. And David led the troops in their campaigns. In everything he did, he had great success because the Lord was with him. When Saul saw how successful he was afraid of him. But all Israel and Judah loved David because he led them in their campaigns. So it was in his jealousy and irrationality that Saul feared David. You wouldn't have guessed that the king would be afraid of this very young man, barely more than a boy. And it seems that perhaps what he most envied was David's godliness. You know, you may have a boss at work who turns on you and you think it is because of your Christian faith, but deep down underneath, at a place that the boss would never admit, it could be that the boss wishes that she or he had the same kind of faith that you have. And Saul then did what some bosses do. He set up David to fail. He appointed him to be a colonel in a regiment with 1,000 soldiers to command. And in those days, the commanders of a regiment would actually lead the soldiers out into battle. In most countries in modern warfare, it's not that way, but it was back then. There's a story that comes from, I don't know, about 50 years ago or so of a young recruit who went through very brief basic training and then was sent into battle. And his first day, he was in a ferocious conflict, and there were soldiers that were being wounded and killed all around him. And he panicked. he put down his weapon and he made a one-man retreat. He just wanted to survive. And so he ran as hard and as fast and as far as he possibly could, ran and ran and ran right into an officer. And the officer, the story goes, recognized that he had a deserter on his hands in the midst of a fierce battle. He was wearing a sidearm. He took it out for a summary court-martial and was going to shoot this young deserter right there on the spot. The story goes, the young deserter dropped to his knees and he pleaded for his life. He said, "Captain, I am so sorry. I know what I did was wrong. Give me another chance. Please, Captain, I'll go back to the front line. I will fight. I'll fight till I'm the last man there. I will not do this again. Please, Captain, spare my life." And so the story goes that the officer had compassion on him and put his sidearm back in his holster and told him to stand up. And he said, "All right, I'm going to give you a second chance. But it's Colonel, not Captain." And the young deserter said, "Oh, I didn't know I was that far back." By putting David in command of the regiment, the expectation was that he would be the first in the fight. And therefore, he was setting him up to be killed. Except to Saul's dismay, David was more victorious than he was before, and he became even more of a national hero. But beware of bosses who give assignments that are designed at their core to cause failure. This bad boss moved on to some very malicious manipulation. Saul said to David, "Here is my older daughter, Merib. I will give her to you in marriage. Only serve me bravely and fight the battles of the Lord." For Saul said to himself, "I'll not raise a hand against him. Let the Philistines do that." So he was the kind of man who would use anything, even his own family members, even his own daughter, to get what he wanted. He remembered this promise from what increasingly became a long time ago, that anybody that would fight the giant Goliath would be given his daughter's hand in marriage, and it was time to make good on that promise. And he saw that as another way to get him killed. He would use his daughter. He would let other people do the kill, the competition. They would do it. This Saul became one evil, conniving, manipulative leader who broke his promises. David said to Saul, "Who am I and what is my family or my father's clan in Israel that I should become the king's son-in-law?" So when the time came for Merib, Saul's daughter, to be given to David, she was given in marriage to Adriel of Mahola. When David responded with humility, Saul changed his mind and allowed his daughter to marry some other guy. So, I mean, you can picture the scene. Here's the wedding. All the promises have been made. Saul's supposed to walk his daughter down the aisle. And instead, has her marry. It gives a whole new meaning to giving away the bride. I mean, he literally gave away the bride to some other guy named Adriel. Remember, he had made a promise. He had made a promise to the entire nation. But when the promise no longer suited him, then the slayer of Goliath didn't get his daughter. He was the kind of boss whose word didn't mean anything. And then he started baiting traps. Now, Saul's daughter, Michal, the younger daughter, was in love with David. And when they told Saul about it, he was pleased. Surprise. "I will give her to him," he thought, "so that she may be a snare to him and so that the hand of the Philistines may be against him." So Saul said to David, "Now you have a second opportunity to become my son-in-law." Then Saul ordered his attendants, "Speak to David privately and say, 'Look, the king is pleased with you and his attendants all like you. Now become my son-in-law.'" They repeated these words to David. But David said, "Do you think it is a small matter to become the king's son-in-law? I'm only a poor man and little known." It must have seemed to Saul as if everybody was in love with David. His son was in love with David. His daughter was in love with David. His officers were in love with David. The members of the court were in love with David. And Saul decided to one more time set a trap. But this time he would bait the trap with his own daughter and with David's humility. That he would set a trap that would pretend to honor his daughter's love, but would get her married off and get her husband killed and break her heart, and who knows, maybe he could use her again for some other personal or political purpose. In those days, the way it worked was that if a guy was going to marry a girl, that he had to pay a bride price to the girl's father. And it was a poor society, so that meant that typically it was livestock, maybe goat or sheep or maybe some money. But the higher up someone was on the social ladder, the higher was the price, and a princess would be at the very top. David couldn't afford a bride price for a king's daughter. He was from a poor family, and he just didn't have those kinds of resources. So it was kind of impossible until Saul proposed a deal. It was sort of that he would sell his daughter for the price of 100 dead Philistine enemies. Now, I'm not going to actually read the exact price, because in the Bible, the exact price is gory and explicit and, well, not well suited to a mixed audience. The price for Michael was, well, it was 100 dead Philistines' specific body parts. I'm going to let you read that for yourself. It's in 1 Samuel 18, verses 24 to 27. Don't read it to your family at home. Just read that privately. Well, there weren't any big battles scheduled that week in Israel and Philistia. That meant that there wouldn't be a large number of Philistines available to kill to meet the bride price, so that David would have to revert to guerrilla warfare, and that was far more dangerous, and it was more likely that he would be killed in the process. It was a trap. But David took the king as his word. He was thrilled with this opportunity. He went out, and he not only met the goal, but he doubled the goal, and he killed 200 Philistines, and Saul was foiled again. And there was a royal wedding between David and Princess Michael. It's a story of escalating animosity. It's a story of Saul, who was the worst boss in the world of that millennium, but he added to his bad behavior with escalating animosity. He was crazy, out of control. When Saul realized that the Lord was with David and that his daughter Michael loved David, Saul became still more afraid of him, and he remained his enemy the rest of his days. And for David, it couldn't be easy either. He no longer could refer to him as your royal majesty. Now he had to call him dad. So you think about your problems with your father-in-law, with your boss, and David seemed to be a whole lot greater. But amazingly, this bad behavior of King Saul, the boss, backfired. Every time it backfired into blessings for David. The Philistine commanders continued to go out to battle, and as often as they did, David met with more success than the rest of Saul's officers, and his name became well known. And I will tell you that this story is in the Bible not just for, or even primarily for, the history of it, although that's good and important. It is primarily for the theology of it. It is to say that when evil is intended, that we have a God that can turn it around into blessing and into good. That God took everything that this mentally, spiritually, and emotionally dysfunctional king did and spun it around and upside down in a way to bless and benefit David and the entire nation of Israel. Now, it didn't seem that way at the time. When somebody's throwing a spear at you, when someone is using family members to manipulate you, when someone is setting up traps to get you killed, when all of the worst possible things are happening, you can hardly imagine that God is there or that God is in it. But he was, and he is. Never think that God has forgotten. Never say that God has been defeated. Never think that doing what is right will automatically make life immediately easy, because it does not. David did pretty much everything right, and it got hard as a result. Maybe you remember a story earlier in the Bible of Joseph. It's in the book of Genesis. He was sold into slavery by his own brothers. Then, as a slave, he was accused of an attempted rape for which he was not guilty, and his boss had him thrown into prison. Everything was turning really wrong. But by the end of the story, in the 50th chapter of the book of Genesis, David is the prime minister of the Egyptian empire, and he sums it all up in a statement he makes to his own brothers who had betrayed him. He said, you intended to harm me, but God intended it for good. That is the theology of the story and of the Bible, that when life is hard, when your boss is bad, when others intend to harm you, that God can turn evil upside down and inside out, turn it into a blessing. Remember that the God of Joseph, the God of David, is your God in your circumstance. He is your God too. Our Father, may we be faithful to you even when the circumstances are the opposite of all we would choose for them to be. May we be like David, who did what was right and good, even when his boss, his father-in-law, his king did everything that could be classified as really bad behavior. Help us to remember in the words of Joseph long ago that even when others intend to do us harm, you intend to do us good, and that you are our God too. We praise you in Jesus' name. Amen.